Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Ballmer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Alana Levine.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey, I heard you needed inspiration. Here's Alana and friends with some revelations. Little known back to the day, every little thing's gonna be A-OK. A-OK.
Little known fact about my guest today. Together with his partner, Mark Shaman, they have created more Broadway content than any two people should be expected to create in a lifetime, but they have done it. And every time there's some grand award handed to them for it. But it is really an incredible honor to sit down and hear the story of how Scott Whitman became one of the most prolific, lauded, brilliant songwriters for Broadway and beyond. Welcome Scott Whitman to the podcast.
A-OK. A-OK.
Hey everyone, my guest today is the Tony Grammy and Olivier Award-winning lyricist, director, writer, and conceiver, Scott Whitman. Scott co-wrote the lyrics for the hit musical Hairspray with creative partner Mark Shaman. Scott was nominated for a Golden Globe, Grammy, and two Emmy Awards for the original songs on NBC's musical drama Smash. Some of Scott and Mark's other Broadway credits include Martin Short, Fame Becomes Me. Scott also directed that show. They also wrote Catch Me If You Can and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. His notorious and legendary downtown shows are in the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Mark and Scott also wrote the score to Disney's Mary Poppins Returns, and their song The Place Where Lost Things Go was nominated for an Oscar. Most recently, Mark and Scott, along with Amber Ruffin and Matthew Lopez, have written a new musical version of Some Like It Hot that is currently on Broadway today as we speak. And at this point, when I've read all of the things that you have been lauded with in awards, you have choices. So why did you make the choice to say yes to Some Like It Hot?
Okay, we were in London shooting Mary Poppins and Returns. And we got a call from Craig Zaden and Neil Meron, who were the producers. And so we had done Smash with them and Hairspray live on TV. They had for a long time had the rights were difficult to attain. So because there already had been a musical in the 70s that David Merrick had produced of it was called Sugar. And it was basically the movie on stage. So Elaine Joyce was in it and she basically imitated Marilyn. And the two men were Tony Roberts and Bobby Moore, so who were very funny. I saw it and because I was in college then when it was in Boston, I think. Anyway, they There was no need to do it again, to do the movie on stage. So the first thing they said to us was, we don't want to try to compete with a Marilyn. What if she's Black? And I thought, well, that's a much more interesting story already, because it's a different type of music. It was more in the Lena Horne, Billie Holiday area, which is a sweet spot for Mark and I to write in. And then they said, and we would like to do it with, if you're into it, with Matthew Lopez. So Matthew had just written this epic drama of The Inheritance, and I had been a fan of his from a play he had done off Broadway called The Legend of Georgia McBride. And he has a very singular voice, and it sounded intriguing. So we sort of got together with Matthew, and sort of he created sort of the DNA of the piece for us. And so then when we got back from Mary Poppins, we started actively writing it. And then later on, we felt we needed another Black voice in the writing team, and Amber joined us, and that was also fruitful. So it's all on stage now. So
yeah.
It was a long process. It was 6 years of workshops and different readings or dance workshops, all of that, all under the leadership of Casey Nicola, who we had worked on an episode of Smash with him, but we always wanted to work with him because we had been working with the same creative teams a lot. We had worked with Jack O'Brien and Jerry Mitchell on a few shows, and it was sort of fun to work with
to make a new friend in the room. Yeah. So and also, obviously, I mean, Casey's been on the show. The thing that's so remarkable about him, and Jerry has this too, is he's a dancer and a choreographer. So to have one person be able to envision both things of both parts of a musical like that is sort of. And by the way, there are so many numbers in the show that have Casey's unique, brilliant, zany. It's so intensely funny and complex, these fabulous, fabulous production numbers. For people listening who don't really understand sort of one person writes the music, composes the music, and one person writes lyrics, although you and Mark have a unique relationship in that you both write lyrics often together. Yes. And then there's the book writer. And sort of when you say Matthew Lopez, by the way, The Inheritance was so extraordinarily beautiful. And our dear friend John Hickey was just so magnificent in it also. And so the fact that he could sort of write The Inheritance and this unbelievably deeply moving but also hilarious musical. What a feather in Matthew Lopez's cap, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, he was, I stopped by the show because I was in Midtown last night.
Yeah.
And, there's so much of it is, I was thinking about how beautiful the writing is sometimes, and but also extremely funny, you know, and he was great too. We enjoyed that process of it.
I guess the question of when it became a story, not just of someone hiding to get, you know, to hide from the police and the mob in drag, when did the idea become, and then in being in drag, this character finds themselves, like some version of themselves is actually more complete than they've ever been. Yeah. I thought that was, you know, I saw it in early preview, so I'd read nothing about it. And so I had no idea that was about to unfold in front of me. So I guess I want to ask you two things. A, the casting's pretty brilliant with Christian Borle and Jay Harrison Gee. So if you could talk about their coming on to the show and how that happened. And then the decision in writing this thing that, okay, this is what we're going to make it. Not just we're going to have a Black woman in the part that we've understood is the Marilyn Monroe part, but so bringing in all of the politics of that time, the specific idea of changing where the story goes in such a huge way.
I think that a lot of that was Matthew. Matthew opened a new window for it, And again, because there already had been a piece on Broadway that was based on the movie, there was no reason to repeat that. So the idea was we needed to make a Some Like It Hot for our time, not married to the 1959, though a lot of the kind of sexual politics of that movie are very advanced, but the world has changed a great deal, obviously. And so it was Matthew who kind of opened that window to that, to the idea that you're uncovering something inside you that's going to, liberate you, let you free. And they all kind of go through that journey, all of them. And so I'm going to have to say pure Matthew, and as far as the two actors go, Christian, we had worked before several times. He was obviously the star of Smash, and also we had done Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. So we knew what we were big fans of his talent. And Jay was with it the longest in the workshops, and so the Jay's non-binary, so that was important to us, and he. The questions he asked were the right ones. And so we addressed those in the writing.
Because when you describe Matthew and even how you just talked about it, sort of wanting to bring it into a more modern space politically or culturally, yet it's still a period piece. So was there any point in time where you guys thought, what if we had it be a present day story? Or was it always meant to be generationally, decades ago, and the viewers not watching something from today, but from history?
Right. Well, we loved the period, and we had moved the period from the movie. The movie is all flappers and Charlestons, and so running wild in the 20s. Matthew wanted to move it to the Depression, so that was also kind of overhanging the atmosphere. And then he wanted it to take place at the end where the end of the story, Prohibition is repealed. So and so that was sort of working backwards from that. So that was in the 1930s. And also it changed a lot of, like, for Greg Barnes, the costume designer, all of that. It's a very different look from had it been the flapper style of the 20s. So it was, and the design elements were affected by that as well.
You and Mark Shaman have been writing together now for how many years?
Okay.
10.
Since I was 10. No, since the 70s. We met in 1976. I was living in New York, and he had just moved to New York, and we had a kind of a clubhouse that was in the East Village. It was called Club 57, and it was in the basement of a Polish Catholic church. And we were a little, at that time, Broadway was kind of ruled by the British musicals. It was that time of those big exports, like Cats and all those things. And so we all felt a little too rock and roll for theater and too theatery for rock and roll. So we had to find kind of a tribe that had a like sensibility. So this little basement clubhouse became kind of it had something in the water, I'll say, because Keith Haring, Ann Magnuson, Kenny Scharf, Jean-Michel Basquiat, we were all there together at that time. Like, Keith would have an art show, and then Mark and I would do, we had dinner theater that we did there once a week on Mondays. And every night it was a different event. So we had found these people who were discovering, who had a similar sense of humor as we did. And it was kind of like an irony that we had an irony about pop culture. And so a lot of the things were influenced by that. And we decided we needed to do an original musical there. And so we wrote a musical called Livin' Dolls, which was about Barbie, how Barbie met Ken. And that was very popular, and it ran for months there, and people would sit on beach blankets and eat pizza and watch it and yell back at the actors and all of that. So that we wrote that out of necessity, because I was already doing, I had done a production of the Trojan Women there that took place in Las Vegas. And then we had done a few things. And then all of a sudden people started coming down there to see it. Tommy Toon and Jay Preston Allen, the writer of Cabaret, and Alan Carr was there all the time, and Joe Papp. And they would be sitting in the audience with, you know, these stoners and junkies watching the shows. So that was in 79, I think 79.
Yeah. And you and Mark became a couple.
Yes, yes, yes. We were together for many years.
Early on in that moment in that basement, were you guys sort of, as soon as you started writing together, did you sort of fall in love at the same time?
Yeah, it evolved over that time. And you know, I'm 5 years older. And so he kind of, over that period of time, we found each other that way, creatively and emotionally. And it continued for quite a long time. And you know, it's still a relationship that we still love each other very much. We're just with different partners now.
So you guys were able, I mean, I bring it up because in 2003, when you guys won the Tony Award for Hairspray, there was something, you know, it's so funny that it kind of rocked the world at the time, because it's so, wouldn't do that today, or at least I'd like to think it wouldn't. But Mark, Scotty's partner, was giving a speech, an acceptance speech, and he thanked the love of his life, who happened to be standing next to him, his co-writer, and you guys kissed.
And we kissed it. It was
on television.
Crazy, a reaction to it, because it was the first same-sex couple kiss on an award show. So we just did, as Mark said, if he had won a dishwasher on The Price is Right, he would have done the same thing. But we literally, it was such a natural thing. And also on stage with us were two very close friends, Matthew Broderick and Sarah Jessica Parker. And I think I actually might have kissed Sarah longer than I kissed Mark. But,
right.
But they, it sort of reverberated. But it was a totally unplanned and just a sort of a natural moment of joy. It was something that we had worked very hard to get to.
So what happened after that? I mean, that night at the award show, it became this sort of this watershed moment, and other, you know, Dennis O'Hare, my husband was in Take Me Out at the time.
Right, won that night. Yes.
And so I remember Dennis then thanking his husband or partner at the time. I mean, and then Michelle Park won, and hurt, like, it became thematically a really beautiful moment throughout that entire show. But then I wonder for you guys afterwards, what was the reaction in the business, in your world? Were there reverberations beyond the beautiful glory of it? Was it a hard moment to navigate in some ways, unexpectedly?
It actually wasn't, because we had, you know, we lived in New York. I would imagine if in other parts of the country, and I did.
Yeah.
They did tell us that they, you know, there was some hate mail about it, and, you know, but it just seemed like a natural moment. Had worked, as I said, worked so hard to get to that. And yeah. it was just an expression of joy. So, I remember, I mean, of course, I remember the all night vividly, but.
What was the thing where you noted as a young person that you have a knack for writing incredible lyrics and rhyming in really complicated, fabulous ways? What was your aha moment?
Well, I was a kid. When I was a kid, I worked in I grew up not far from New York, just outside of Nyack, which is, you know, was pretty close to New York. And I went to the Academy of Dramatic Arts in New York, and I worked at a theater called the Tappan Zee Playhouse, which sadly is no longer there. And I was like 14, 15, and I would be an apprentice. I was an apprentice, and they would do a show every week, but a star would be in it. But an old time star like Betty Grable and Van Johnson and people like that, they would come through that town and do the show. And so I wasn't paid, didn't get any money. I had to ride my bike there at all hours. Sometimes I'd be there for almost 18 hours a day working. But my parents sort of allowed it. They said, you know, you obviously want this. So prior to that, I had made a theater in my backyard and did Tennessee Williams plays. So, you know, it was just something that I was so wanted to be a part of. I would have done anything. It's funny. It's just a passion that, and I originally thought, maybe I'll go to New York and be an actor in, but I didn't enjoy that side of it. I liked being on the other side of the table. So after a while, when you got together with Mark and we created a world where we were in control of. So.
So you weren't writing musicals that your friends and family were doing in your backyard. You just were a lover of.
No, and I read every play, and I went to, you know, I would go to the theater every Saturday in New York because I would get on the bus. And I went to class and at the Academy in the mornings and went to matinees in the afternoon and saw, you know, everything. But I couldn't get enough of it. I say, you know, it's like a grease paint in your veins, you know. I went to college and got further into it. And by the time I came to New York, and Mark and I decided we were going to write this musical together. And I had never written, you know, lyrics or anything. But Mark had, you know, Mark's brain worked in a way that he almost schooled me in it. So we have a very, you know, gentle collaboration where we sit together for, you know, in this room for hours and hours a day and try to get something, you know, first you're paralyzed with fear. And then by the end of the day, you have something on paper together. And obviously the more you do something, the more you kind of hone the craft of it.
Right. So you never took classes. You never did, you know, like, I don't know, the BMI, whatever those workshops are that they have now for musical theater writers. It was trial and error and just collaborating together.
It was. Oddly, the Barbie and Ken musical got a lot of attention. Mark was working at the Public Theater then, and they had come to see it, and something had fallen out of the schedule at the Manhattan Theater Club. So Lynn Meadow said, would you bring that musical to the up there? This is when it was way uptown on East 72nd Street or something.
Right.
So we did, we moved the show, but sadly Mattel wouldn't give us the rights to the names. So we had to change all that. So we kind of lost a little bit of its magic there.
But well, the pop culture-ness of it.
Yeah. I mean, they looked they dressed like those characters, and John Lee Beatty had done this beautiful set, which was the Barbie carrying case that opened up and everything was in it. And so, but it was kind of rock and rollish for the Manhattan Theater Club at that time.
So does that musical still exist somewhere? Like, do you think about putting it up?
No, it's deep in a drawer. But right. I go back and listen to, I was found it or like some lyrics that there's so, they're primitive, I would say.
early Whitman Sheeman.
Right. Yes.
Hairspray was your first Broadway musical?
Yes.
So that's how long from Barbie and Ken in the Basement to Manhattan Theater Club to Hairspray on Broadway? How many years was
that? I had done a lot of, I had sort of established a name for myself in the cabaret world.
Right.
And also I spent most of the 80s I did hundreds of shows in Danceteria, Studio 54, at the Limelight. They would give me a budget. Ian Schrager or Rudolph from Danceteer, they would give me, they'd say, here's $10,000 and you do put on a show. And I would keep most of the money, pay everybody in drink tickets. And then this is before DJs were the stars.
Okay.
I used to think, oh, well, if you do a big extravaganza, it'll bring people in. So these shows were at, 1 o'clock in the morning.
What can you just describe a little bit? Like when you say show, like, what do you mean?
Okay. I did one that was the Bible in 20 minutes. It was called Pagan Place and it had over 200 people in it. And they were literally, they would show, you had to come up with your own costume with a certain guidelines. I had people who kind of shepherd them around. And then I would have three or four people who were sort of standouts. Then Joey Arias was in those, a great guy named John Sex, another, Ann Magnuson. They would be the headliners. And so I did that. I did another one called Nude Faces of 1985. And that was at Danceteria. That had a huge cast. It was all, sailors and things like that. So.
When you, you're in New York in the 80s, and so it's this incredible, incredibly creative time, right? And pushing boundaries, and then the loss, the amount of loss in the community at the same time is still weighs heavily on all of us, right? I mean, decades
well
later.
Yeah, when I wasn't doing these shows, I was going to putting together memorials or going to them. And it was interesting because MoMA just did this huge retrospect about Club 57 because so much artwork had come out of it. And part of that was these shows that had been very crudely videotaped and all of that. And they restored all that and put them in their collection there for this. But it was to see those again after all these years and realize that almost 85% of those people who were in those shows are no longer with us. So for both Mark and I, New York became haunted. And so Mark's career was starting to take off in the movies. And so mm-hmm. he said, well, I think we should move to California. And so we did. We went to LA for 10 years, and I didn't really, he was doing movie after movie. And then Patti LuPone was in a TV show out there called Life Goes On. And she came to a party we lived in Laurel Canyon. She came to a party at that house. Jeffrey Richmond brought her. And she said, I want to sing. I want to do a show. And somebody told me, you're the guy who could do it. And I said, because I had done a lot of cabaret acts, Christine Ebersole, Edie Beale, I worked on her cabaret act. I mean, it was a lot of cabarets there. And in New York, you couldn't swing a cat without hitting one.
Bette Midler.
And the High Heel Women was a group I worked with. And,
wow.
And there was a lot of them. Anyway, Patti wanted to sing. And so I put a show together for her, and we did it at the Geffen Playhouse there. And lo and behold, they said, we want to move it to Broadway. So I started migrating back slowly over time.
So that was your Broadway debut.
Yes, it was called Patti LuPone on Broadway.
Yeah.
I had directed and conceived that. So
incredible. And that was the beginning. I mean, I don't know that there, I was looking at your resume. I mean, to say Raquel Welch, you did a show with Raquel Welch. Is that true?
Well, we were friends. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So a lot, very eclectic group.
Yes, a very eclectic group. Yeah.
I have to, just because my listeners, and they are global, and they are all of them from Brazil to Teaneck, obsessed with Smash. I mean, it was just this phenomena. I mean, of all the things that people wrote into me wanting to talk to you about, the repeat offenders of wanting to know more about Bombshell and Smash, the amount that you guys had to write and produce weekly, I just find it extraordinary how much you had to write. And the idea that you had to write not just for the Broadway musical, but that these songs had to work both for the musical and the characters within the show, it's very heady to me trying to understand how you negotiated that.
It was very complex.
Yeah.
When it started, they didn't know. They knew, the idea originally came from Steven Spielberg, and he wanted to do a thing where they would write a musical in this real time. It was supposed to be for Showtime.
Okay.
And they write a musical in real time, and at the end of that season, do the show on Broadway. So
really do the show on Broadway?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, on Showtime, you probably could have spent an hour with two people sitting at a piano writing
a show.
But when it moved to network, it then had to be a more of a soap,
okay,
in a way that, you know, we had to have a cliffhanger. But everyone was very stuck on what is the musical that they would do, and so I had suggested, what if it's about Marilyn Monroe? And that was that everyone went ding, ding, ding. That's perfect, because it has her ambition and struggle and all of that could feed into the girls
competing,
Megan and Kat competing for that.
Yeah.
So that became the sort of the engine for us. So we would literally write a song on Monday. The girls would come maybe on Tuesday and do the demo, and then they would stage it on Thursday and shoot it on Friday. So it was that hectic of pace. So
I mean other than like Glee, which also I can't even imagine like the pace with which they had to that became for a soap opera, the investment from its audience. And I knew Teresa Rebeck and I knew David Marshall Grant. I knew all the people who became the showrunners throughout. And so I know it was very fraught. That's
like
a whole
call
other
it Vietnam.
Show.
I call it Vietnam.
That's the musical. And it's funny because, I mean, you have, you know, Spielberg at the top, right? Who's sort of known to be the most calm, you know, Sweden in the room in terms of keeping everyone invested in the thing.
He is what I love about him is that he is an audience member. I mean, that is his total, that is so much about who he is and what he reacts to, and he just feels like he's in the audience. So I love that about him. So
that he's a fan of the thing.
Yes, this is what I want to see if I was in the audience. And so it's a wonderful quality for a director or a producer.
There's been so much talk over the years of Bombshell actually coming to Broadway. Is that still on the back burner somewhere?
No, it's actually on a front burner. Are they... Rick Ellis and Bob Martin, who are two Broadway book writers, and they said, we'd like to take a crack at creating a story. And so they went off with the catalog of songs and figured it out. And so it was in the summer. We did a reading for like 29-hour work session with the cast, no director, and the guys sort of really woodshedded and create, and all week we rearranged and rewrote, and at the end of it came out with a very funny sort of noises off version of Smash. So they call it a play about a musical. So all the songs are in there, and we wrote some new ones as well. And then by chance, Spielberg's daughter was getting married. And so he was in town and he said, oh, I'm in town, can I come to the reading? And he came to the reading and was, you know, overjoyed by it. So there's another workshop in the coming year, and we're about to bring on a director and all of that. But it's very funny. I laughed a lot at it.
For the meta of it all, are you allowed to say who was playing Marilyn in the 29-hour reading in these workshops?
Well, yeah, because I think a lot of pictures, you know, Stephen took pictures with everybody. So it went out there. It was a funny group. It was just for this. It was Megan was in it, and Megan Hilty and Bonnie Milligan and Christine Nielsen was very funny, and Beth Level and Brooks Hishmanskas. It was a very funny group of people, and really game for it, because it is like Noises Off, where they're putting on a musical of Marilyn, but everything goes wrong in the production of it.
Well, that's thrilling. Before I let you go, as is the tradition on this podcast, I end each episode asking my guests to share a little known fact about themselves. And I wonder if you have something you could share.
Oh my, a little known fact about myself. A little known fact, I'm painfully shy. I know you might not believe it, but I actually am. I don't really enjoy getting up in public and doing things. I mean, I'm lucky that in my life, I've had Mark always by my side, and he's the more gregarious and more forward person. So I'm very relaxed to be in the background. So,
well, Scott Whitman, thank you for being in my foreground for this entire conversation.
I enjoyed your foreground.
All right. Well, I will see you soon, and thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you. I enjoyed it a lot. Thanks.
I'm so glad. One more thing. I keep getting emails asking how to donate to the podcast. First of all, thank you in advance. You are the kindest humans. Just go to littleknownfactspodcast.com/donations. That is where you donate. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Clouds can make the wind blow. Bugs can make the grass grow. So there you go. These are little known facts that you know. This episode of Little Known Facts was edited by Nicholas Klar. We record in New York City. The Little Known Facts theme song was written and recorded and sung by Georgia Famusa, with backup vocals by Caleb Famusa. Thank you.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.